Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we can notice the effect of having spent almost a week in retreat in very extremely fortunate circumstances. I was very grateful to Ajahn Amaro for the way that he kind of started us off with, you know, quite a lot of guidance, instruction, encouragement, and a very clearly defined structure for the first part of the retreat, so that all of us are here for certain hours of the day and sitting, walking. And I also very much appreciate the extent to which we've all been able to keep pretty quiet, actually. I really value these things as supports for practice. I mean, even though I've been practicing for many, many years, even though I've taught retreats, and I still really value hearing the same encouragement over and over again. It's interesting, even the Buddha, he... actually, it's a bit of digression, but... maybe we won't... You're probably curious now. One of the suttas we chant, the Bodhanga Sutta, the Sutta on the Enlightenment Factors, which is a chant that we recite when somebody's very poorly, very unwell. One of the verses in that describes a situation where the Buddha was very, very sick, and although he surely must have known what the Enlightenment Factors were, he asked... I think it was Venerable Moggallana to repeat them. And sort of hearing them was a kind of encouragement in his practice. And I mean, I'm certainly not comparing myself with the Buddha, but the point I'm making is that sometimes, even though one might know a particular teaching intellectually, there's something about just hearing it and reflecting on it that seems to have a potency. So, you know, we've had this chance, this encouragement to be quiet and to focus very much on being here and now. And for the attention to be directed inwardly, just attending to our own hearts and minds. So it's been a very quiet time. Relatively speaking, in the monastery, not much conversation, not much aside from the kind of routine of the monastic life, and not a lot of excitement. But I can imagine that for most people, there's probably been a fair bit going on inside. Because one of the things that this kind of structure brings about is that it makes us very much aware of the inner chatter. You know, take away a bit of external chatter and you suddenly realize what goes on inside, the ways that we comment on different things, the ways that we judge things, criticize things. You know, there can be all kinds of voices going on in there. And it can be, although it's peaceful on the outside, it can be very unpeaceful on the inside. I remember the first ever winter retreat we had at Chithurst. It was quite a short one, I think, maybe even a couple of weeks. Not a long time. It came at a time that... there was absolutely no money to do anything, and the weather was pretty bad, so we Ajahn Sumedho decided that we would set aside the time to meditate. There was nothing much else we could do. And I remember the interview, we all had interviews with him, and I remember just, you know, freely acknowledging that I hadn't had a single moment of peace in the, I don't know how many days it was that we'd been sitting and walking together, but not one moment of peace, either in the meditation or walking up and down the lane or at any time of the day. My mind was completely obsessed with one thing after another. And it was only when he suggested that we pay attention to the feet when we were doing mukhi meditation that I actually did have a moment or two of calm. But I think that was about the only calm I had during the whole retreat. So if you are having a lot of thinking, I wouldn't suggest that you worry about it too much. This is just kind of normal. It's what happens when many of the usual distractions are taken away. Either the ways, the activities, the reading, writing, TV, entertainments, and also conversation, of course, ways of interaction, sort of the ways that we can express ourselves, very, very limited, very much reduced. And so it all goes inwards, it all kind of happens inside. We're encouraged in our practice to find a balance. And the Buddha's teachings is all about the middle way, the way between the extremes. And in relation to the activities of the mind, one of the ways I like to reflect on the possible extremes is the one where we just try to repress, just try to shut everything down. And you know, some people can do this with samadhi. They can just develop very, very strong focus in their practice through an effort of will. And just make the mind completely blank, quiet through that. If we can't actually succeed at that, we can get into a kind of battle where we try. We, you know, whenever a thought comes up, we just try to sit on it, try to squeeze it out in some way. And the mind, when we do that, just tends to get very miserable, very rebellious, and it doesn't really bring a very pleasant sense of calm into the mind. At least it never has for me. Just this kind of battleground that can go on when we just try to make the mind shut up, just try to repress things out of consciousness. And the other extreme, of course, is just to not follow the thoughts, just to allow thinking to take over and get carried away in all kinds of trains of thoughts. You know, often thoughts about the monastery or the routine or how things are done, or you know, we can get very critical of other people, completely obsessed with how somebody moves around or does things, or and it's often just you know, we can get fixated onto one person, get really concerned about one person and what they're doing and how they're doing it. Or we can get very obsessed about ourselves. You know, how we are, how we should be practicing. you know, whether we're any good or not. And that can seem like quite a worthy occupation, really. Self-criticism, self-judgment. But in some ways it's the other extreme from the extreme of repression, denial. It's like another kind of indulgence when we give free rein to our thinking mind, the critical mind, the judging mind, or the desire mind, sort of wanting to get different things, fantasizing. So as I said, our practice is about the middle way. And I was very struck by the kind of instructions that Ajahnamara was giving us the first days, just, you know, really encouraging a sense of presence, and kind of easeful abiding with things as they are. Recognizing the tendency of the mind to run off after different thoughts, ideas, planning, worrying, criticizing, just noticing that tendency and just coming back again and again to the quality of presence, present moment awareness with the body, with the breath, with the way things are. Doing it in a very easeful, gentle way, not a harsh or demanding, brutal kind of way, but just a sort of gentle, you know, come back, come back, come back, pay attention to this, try this, take an interest in this. You know, finding ways of getting the mind interested in presence. Enjoying the sensation of the body breathing, enjoying the fragrance of the incense, or I don't know about you, but I love the light in the temple. You know, I love noticing the changing light. And it's lovely for us to be in here in the morning time, just watching the sunlight, you know, in the middle of the morning, and the changing light in the evening time, just watching the light fade. This is all part of what's happening here and now. It's all part of being present, which is what our aspiration is right now, to be present. So all of the focusing practices, samadhi practices, it's all about, you know, bringing our awareness into the present so that we can observe, learning about the mind, learning about the habits of the mind, the patterns of thinking, you know, the ways that we respond to life, the ways that we cause ourselves suffering. And that's the key to it, that's the crux of it. You know, how do we cause ourselves suffering? And do we really need to do that? You know, might there be a different way of relating to ourselves, relating to the experiences of our life? A way that is lighter, that is freer, that is more joyful. And this is something that this is what the Buddha actually, his great gift to humanity is just to consider that perhaps there's another way of responding to life rather than struggling all the time, struggling with ourselves, struggling with the situation, struggling with each other, all the shoulds and the shouldn'ts, Finding this easeful abiding with things as they are. So focusing on, you know, what's calming, what's soothing, what enables a sense of settling in the mind. And one of the things I've been noticing about nature right now is how it's very, it's cold, that's one thing I've been noticing. But I'm really enjoying that. But I've also been noticing kind of how unexciting it is, how soothing it is. I was contemplating today how I'm noticing there's no flowers, or at least I haven't noticed many flowers out in nature. I mean, we have flowers on the shrine, just looking around, looking in the garden around the kuti where I stay, and nothing is flowering. And we could think, well, how miserable, how dreary. But I just find it very peaceful. Because flowers are very beautiful, but they're quite exciting, aren't they? They're quite stimulating. They're sort of bright. They kind of say, look at me, aren't I wonderful, aren't I beautiful? Look at me. And they really draw our attention. And just the foliage, the leaves, the trees that don't have leaves, just seeing the shapes of the trees. The soil, grass, stones, earth, and the softness of the light, the sky. These are all things that are kind of undemanding. And as I said, I'm finding it very, very pleasant. It's a kind of soothing, something to attune to in a sort of soothing way. So if the mind is perhaps not so calm, not so at ease, you know, if there are a lot of exciting, stimulating thoughts going on in there, feelings of urgency or planning, or, and those of you who cook, you know, probably maybe do have some quite exciting thoughts about what you're going to cook. And people who haven't cooked for years and years and years will find that hard to understand, but I remember when I used to cook, it was always quite exciting, you know, planning what you were going to cook. And the mind can be completely obsessed with, you know, what you're going to cook and how you're going to cook it. And if there is a lot of thinking, then you can consider just, you know, contemplating nature as it is right now. Just really looking at the sky, at the colours in the sky. Looking at the shapes of the trees, the colour of the earth, the leaves. Yeah, focusing on that as something that can help the mind to settle. Just in the same way that the awareness of the breath, you know, can help the mind to settle. So rather than feeling that we've got to force the mind to settle, you know, make it shut up, concentrate, we can see the practice much more of as a kind of enabling, you know, suggesting and encouraging, supporting a sense of calm, a sense of settledness. When we're keeping silence like this, one of the things I've found is a tendency to become much more sensitive in some ways. They're much more aware of each other. And a tendency to kind of read things in and we to... you know, the way that somebody looks at us, or you know, if we do have, you know, an exchange with somebody else, that we can become quite affected by that in ways that might not happen otherwise. You know, what does she think of me? You can sort of think, you know, oh, maybe that person's upset with me. Maybe, or we can become very much aware of the things that we do, you know, oh, maybe I've upset that person, you know, maybe, or how dare she, you know, how dare he look at me like that, how dare she look at me like that. You know, just little tiny things can really have an effect. And I would suggest that rather than seeing this as a problem, a disturbance to our practice, you know, stirring up all kinds of unfortunate things, is to see it as an opportunity. You know, a way that we can learn something about ourselves. That we can learn about the ways that we create the world. That we create our world. I used to be quite puzzled by this when some of the suttas, the Buddha says, you know, that within this fathom-long form, it's just this body and mind, we create the world. We create the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. And I mean, it's still something that I puzzle about a bit. But it can be an interesting thing just to notice if something has upset you or confused you. You know, something that somebody's done or said, or something that you've done or said, just to notice the way that the mind creates a whole drama around it. A whole sense of who and what you are. We don't usually notice so much the times that we create ourselves as something rather wonderful, because that's nice. And when we're feeling happy and at ease, we don't tend to make very much of that. We just enjoy it. It's more the times that we create ourselves as something miserable, not very good. You know, I'm no good, I shouldn't have done and said that. I really shouldn't have done that. that was a terrible mistake. I'm really not very good. And, you know, all the story around that. And we can carry those kind of stories around for days. And it's really important that we try to bring awareness to what's going on. Because I notice in my own practice, I can very easily get completely lost in that. I can believe it totally. Never thinking to question, is this really the case? A story I tell from time to time is of an experience I had on a retreat many years ago. I was down at Chithurst. And it was probably one of the more miserable retreats, self-retreats, that I've had. But it was also, there was one particular moment that was very, very illuminating. Because I was really doing a number on myself as to how useless I was and how it'd be much better if I just died, really. I got into comparing myself with one of the other sisters and how good she was and how hopeless I was, the way one does. And I remember one day just looking out over the lake, standing outside my kuti with this voice going on in my mind, this reality that I'd kind of created for myself, this sense of self, you'll notice, bhava tanha, this desire to be. And if you can't be somebody wonderful, then you'll be somebody terrible. So I'd created this really terrible, useless nun person. And all of a sudden, as I was kind of standing there, looking out over the lake, this wonderful voice came into my mind, saying, "It's not how you think it is." And the whole thing just fell away. So these voices that create a sense of who and what we are, this is Mara. This is the voice of delusion. This is not to be believed. This is to be challenged, to be questioned. In whatever way you can find to challenge or question it. This is a time for waking up out of the dream that we create about who and what we are. This dream, this world that we create for ourselves. And we may only be able to wake up for a brief moment of actually just feeling the breath as it enters and leaves the body. A brief moment when we feel the mat underneath us, when we feel the clothing on our skin, when we feel the air on our face, when we actually taste the food that we're eating. We actually feel the texture of the food in our mouth. Coming to our senses. These expressions, suddenly I came to my senses. A way of waking up out of the dream that we create for ourselves. The dream that we get lost in. When it's a happy dream, we don't actually mind being lost in it. We don't see the suffering of being lost in a happy dream. But when it's a miserable dream, we certainly see plenty of suffering then. But whether it's a happy dream or a miserable dream, it's still a good idea to wake up. So for all of us, you know, during this retreat time, there will be times, probably lots and lots of times, when we'll get lost in a dream. A bad dream, a good dream, a mediocre kind of dream. And over again, we have the opportunity to wake up, to come to our senses, to establish presence, so that more and more in our lives, rather than living in a dream, we can live in the present, we can live, enjoy our waking moments. Waking up out of the illusion of being somebody, living in a world of other somebodies. Establishing our refuge in presence, in the Buddha, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, a refuge that is secure and solid, that is not vulnerable in the way that this sense of me, who and what I am, is vulnerable. So easily upset, so easily shattered, confused, humiliated. So in our lives, living in the monastery, we cultivate wholesome qualities. We cultivate generosity. Giving ourselves to the practice, supporting each other, serving, helping. You know, whenever there's an opportunity, whatever way we can, and in some ways we can see, like, cultivating generosity and cultivating joy as being almost synonymous. Cultivating a joyful, generous heart. And cultivating sila. A sense of harmlessness, a sense of honesty, not taking advantage of one another. Clarity, brightness of mind. So this retreat offers us many, many opportunities. And I really celebrate the fact that we have a good chunk of time to focus with much more energy and enthusiasm on this path of practice, on this path of waking up, without the numerous demands that are often made on our time and energy when we're not in this retreat mode. So these are a wide-ranging selection of reflections that I offer for your consideration this evening.
Handamayang dhamma kataya sadhu karang dadama se.